Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I am your host, Andrew Swetman, and today we are finally finishing up our series on film noir with a look at a neo-noir. It's 1974's Chinatown, directed by Roman Polanski and starring Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway. The always wonderful Rance Collins is back once again to help us finish out the series. Don't go anywhere. Hey, if you love Art House Garage, make sure to check out our Patreon. You can support the show and get ad-free episodes, extended and uncut episodes, bonus episodes, and video episodes. And now, Patreon supporters can get 15% off Art House Garage merch in our web store, including our latest design, which says, "Cinema is spiritual." Get it on a t-shirt, hoodie, or a coffee mug today. To support us on Patreon, go to patreon.com/arthousegarage or find a link in the show notes. Welcome to Art House Garage. Many weeks ago, we started a series looking at film noir. These are the visually and thematically dark films of the 1930s and 1940s that became hugely influential, inspiring films and filmmakers for decades to come. This is the fourth and final episode in our noir series. If you've missed any of the previous episodes, you can go back now. The films we covered are The Third Man from 1949, Nightmare Alley from 1947, and In a Lonely Place from 1950. You can still see elements of noir all over the place in movies today, but then some movies go beyond merely containing touches of noir, and they fully embrace the format that noir came to be known for. Today's film, Chinatown, came out in 1974, many years after the heyday of film noir, but it fits the mold of noir so thoroughly in its style and its story that it came to be known as neo-noir. We'll talk all about the details of the film that fit with the noir tradition in just a few minutes. My guest is once again Rance Collins. Rance is the biggest classic film nerd I know and co-hosts his own podcast, The Envelope Please, all about the history of the Oscars. He has also worked for Turner Classic Movies and some other film-related outlets, and I'm always thrilled when he gives his time to come on the show and enlighten us with his deep-cut film knowledge. As we've been doing for this series, the first section of the discussion is spoiler-free. We talk about the context and just the basics to try to set you up for the best viewing experience if you've never seen the film before. Then you can pause the show, go watch it, and return for the spoiler talk. We talk all about Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway, and the complicated legacy of director Roman Polanski, and we get into the many ways the film connects to the history of film noir. So, without further ado, here is my conversation with Rance Collins about 1974's Chinatown.
Los Angeles, 1937. There are lots of guys like J.J. Gittes. They're easy to find, if you want to find them.
Mr. Gittes, have we ever met?
Well, no.
Never?
Never.
Since you agree with me that we've never met before, you must also agree with me that I've never hired you to do anything, certainly not spy on my husband. I don't get tough with anyone, Mr. Gittes. My lawyer does.
You do your job, and sometimes you find the answers to questions that should never be asked. Or you find out what happens to people who ask them.
Hold it there, kitty cat.
You're a very nosy fellow, kitty cat, huh? You know what happens to nosy fellows?
I dislike the word cheat.
Did you have affairs?
Mr. Gittes.
Did he know about it? Where were you when your husband died?
Welcome back to the podcast, Rance Collins. How are you?
Oh my goodness, it feels like it's been forever and yet a day.
Right. Yeah, like remember way back when we were doing that film noir series? I finally gotta finish that up.
yeah, I vaguely remember being in the shadows so long ago.
You know, we're looking at neo-noir today, so it's like we needed a break. You know, we're kind of mirroring the timeline. There was all these movies back in the 30s, 40s. Now we're jumping to 1970, so we had to have
and a little
time.
And then there was a 20-year break, and here we are now. man. Yeah. Okay.
Well,
neo-noir. We're talking about what is probably the quintessential of that genre alongside Taxi Driver and a couple others. And, you know, this movement that happens in the 70s where there's kind of a resurgence of, you know, pulpy crime dramas that are filled with dark characters and shadows and detecting, you know, you have filmmakers like Roman Polanski, like Martin Scorsese, who are now studying these films that came out in the 40s, and their heroes are the Howard Hawks and the Billy Wilder, and so they're. I think that what's interesting about the neo-noir movement is that it is perhaps really the first real indication of film school or students of film working their way into mainstream cinema.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of someone in 1974 seeing this and, you know, maybe not knowing a lot about film noir and how interesting it might feel to just kind of be immersed in that world. But yeah, Chinatown is such an interesting film. I'd seen it once before. I think I watched it in college, but I had forgotten. I mean, I'd forgotten kind of the twists, which was nice.
I mean, it's a hard twist to forget. I'm surprised that you.
Actually, I studied abroad, and it was like we watched things in class, and I was often really tired. So anyway, I was like, I'm really glad I gave this another shot because I clearly did not give it the fair shake the first time.
We'll wait a little bit to mention what that spoiler is because
I
feel like we have to talk about it. But
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
What we'll do is kind of what we've done with the others is we'll first be spoiler free and talk about the actors who are in it and kind of give some context. And if in case you've never seen it, then you can pause the show and go watch it. And then we'll get into spoilers after that point. So, all right. So, yeah, this is directed by Roman Polanski. Should we start there? That's maybe a big topic to start with. He's a controversial figure.
Yeah. This is his zenith, if you will. You know, Roman Polanski has such an interesting, complicated, controversial history. He has been unable to enter the United States for 40 some odd years because he raped I believe 14-year-old.
Yeah. 13, 14. Yeah.
13, 14-year-old girl. But because it's interesting because the narrative around that up to Me Too really was very, I think, regressive and, and you had a lot of very prominent celebrities still working with him in the countries that they will not extradite him from. And, you know, he made The Pianist, which was, you know, a Harold film in 2001.
Yeah, okay, won
Adrian
Brody.
Yeah. He won Best Director for 2002. He won Best Director for that movie. And he got a standing ovation, even though he clearly could not be at the ceremony. And so public opinion has really turned on him in the last few years because I think we're finally... As a culture, I mean, because it literally, I honestly think it was all these people were just like, well, it's statutory rape. No big thing. And that's really unhealthy and really sick, honestly.
Yeah.
But that's a cultural shift that is thankfully happening. And regardless of your feelings on that, this man still put out some work that is very significant in film history. This movie came before that incident. What is even more complicated and fascinating about Roman Polanski's history is he also is directly tied to one of the most, if not the most, notorious murder in Hollywood history. His wife, Sharon Tate, was murdered in 1969 by the Manson family, the cult led by Charles Manson, along with three or four house guests that particular night.
Sure.
There was another couple that was killed the following night. And it was part of this rampage that ultimately ended with Charles Manson spending the rest of his life in prison. But he literally, he was out of the country working on something. And that's the only reason he wasn't killed that night. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Sharon Tate was 8.5 months pregnant with their baby. So the thing that's complicated about Polanski, who, by the way, also had a film that had only been released a year prior at that point in time called Rosemary's Baby.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that all plays in as in and is significant. Is that there? It's just like you can't avoid him when talking about Hollywood history. You can't avoid mm-hmm. him when talking about movies from this period because he, like it or not, is behind some very influential films. Chinatown is, I would say, the most significant of those films. And Chinatown is also a movie that was released in probably the year that neo-noir really went, viral, if you will. Mm-hmm. And 1974, which is honestly one of the most stacked years in movie history. Mm-hmm. So... there you go.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah, having, and again, like, you're right, like, I think when I, so like, I watched this movie 10 years ago and I kind of had a vague idea that he had some scandals, but yeah, there wasn't the cultural, I've since, researched more about it, but there wasn't this, it didn't seem like a huge black mark on his, person at the time. And
people were
now
still working with him,
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting counterpoint to like Woody Allen in a similar way that, such influential movies. And now, we again, culturally understand that they're predators and have done terrible things. And so it's interesting to can we separate the art from the artist? And we're going to talk about spoilers of this movie in a minute. But like, really, that gets even messier when you think about some of the things that happen in this film, which is interesting. But well, let's talk about Jack Nicholson, which will be a slightly more cheerful thing to talk about. Jack Nicholson is a star of this film.
Who no one has seen anything of in years now.
Yeah. I was thinking about like the last time I saw him in something. I mean, The Departed came to mind. I think I've seen him since then in something.
I remember when he was at the Oscars. It's probably been 10 years. And he was like kind of flirting with Jennifer Lawrence. Do you remember that? I remember that happening, and I don't know if he's made many public appearances since then, but Jack Nicholson, I think, has given out the Best Picture Oscar more than anyone in history. And I don't know if you remember this, but there was a few years where, I mean, he gave out the Departed Oscar. The year before that, he very infamously announced Crash as the Best Picture winner and gave the best line reading of that word ever, because he watched the tape, if you haven't seen it, because he literally opens the envelope. Ang Lee just won Best Director for Brokeback Mountain. Everybody's expecting that to win. Mm-hmm. He opens the envelope and just holds it up so everyone can see it and goes, Crash.
Not my fault.
I didn't do it.
Oh, wow.
But Jack Nicholson at this point in time, he burst onto the scene really with Easy Rider in 69, And, you know, that was such a cultural movie because it was these hippies, you know, going through the desert on motorcycles, free spirits, very much encapsulated the time. And he continued to be kind of this counterculture figure in these very progressive movies like Five Easy Pieces and Carnal Knowledge, Mike Nichols' Carnal Knowledge. And so he was very much a man of the moment and very representative, you know, with his non-traditional look of the 70s. I think it's maybe the quintessential 70s leading man, you know, him and Donald Sutherland and maybe a couple others are all in that weird. They don't look like your typical movie stars, and they're kind of shaggy and have a hard edge to them. And even though their method, most of them are from the method acting training, there's this quality about them that really does harken back to the non-traditional leading man of Jimmy Cagney and Humphrey Bogart. You know, in fact, Jimmy Cagney, I think, is a really, really close approximation, you know. Yeah. Elliot Gould is another one who makes a lot of movies in this period who is not your typical leading dude. And he made a few neo-noirs, including that movie where he lives at the top of an apartment building that's a tower. And it's
I'm going to look it up really quick.
He plays Philip Marlowe, and it's called...
Is it The Long Goodbye?
The Long Goodbye. Which character does he play?
Philip Marlowe, yep.
Okay, good. Got it right.
Yes. Nailed it.
But I mean, like, Jack Nicholson is so atypical. And, you know, he spends half this movie with, like, a bloodied up nose. And
that's the thing I could remember the most. Is like, he has, like, a bandage on his nose for a lot of the movie, doesn't he? And yeah, he does. He's such a movie star feeling in this, though. Like, he's so energetic and, like, and just such a smart ass in some of his line readings that made me laugh. I'll share one in a little bit. Okay. Once we get a spoiler talk, but it's not really a spoiler, but I was just gleeful with how he read
well,
it.
Don't you love too how this is such a tribute to noir? It also takes place in LA, which a lot of noir films did. Big Sleep, those types of movies usually took place in Los Angeles. This one, it's one of the best LA movies ever because you do go on location to a lot of sites around the city and you see this kind of seedier area of the city. It has to, the plot, in case if anyone cares, there's a murder involved, water rights in Los Angeles. Some of it's based on true stories. None of it's real. Don't take this as a documentary footage of water rights in Los Angeles.
Yeah. It's such an interesting, like, on the surface, kind of a boring thing to have the plot around, but I mean, it's a really thrilling thing. And I did just in a little bit of reading, like the true things it is sort of based on. It's pretty interesting. LA history.
It's like Mulholland is involved, I think.
Yes.
Somehow.
Yeah.
Mulholland Drive is a really famous street in LA. And he was a big, developer, and he was responsible for this dam project that went awry and ended up killing a bunch of people because it didn't hold.
450 people or something.
And then he lived kind of the rest of his life in obscurity, but you know, now he has a street named after him. So nobody...
apparently he had inspected it that day, and later that day it went out.
And like houses and just so, like,
yeah. You know, so part of the plot of this story, which is not a spoiler, just kind of the setup, one of the people of interest kind of mirrors that there had been a scandal. And so they're trying to build a new water feature, and he doesn't want to because of the previous thing that he had been at fault for. Yeah. And that's right at the beginning of the story. But
but so, we end anyway, up learning that this guy, who, by the way, let's not forget to mention that it's John Huston.
Yes.
And John Huston is often credited with directing the first true film noir, in The Maltese Falcon. So
yes,
we get John Huston acting in this movie, which is largely a tribute to the type of film he created, which is a nice full circle.
Yeah, and I guess we can't talk too much about his role without getting the spoiler stuff, but he is he's significant in this as well. And really,
but he's connected a good performance. He is connected to Faye Dunaway.
Faye Dunaway's character, and so she is the other big name, I guess, in this. And
this was a really big movie for her too, because she and Jack Nicholson were both nominated for this actor and actress. But Faye kind of burst onto the scene again in the late 60s. Her breakout is Bonnie and Clyde, which is another great influential film. And then she also is involved in some other really big movies in the late 60s, like The Thomas Crown Affair. And she is initially known for, you know, being this kind of fashion beauty trendsetter. In addition to an actress, the Bonnie and Clyde style ends up kind of bringing back this whole beret hat thing. And then Thomas Crown Affair is just one of the most stylish movies ever made. And it was remade as well in the 90s. But anyway, she kind of stalled out for a little bit in the early 70s and hadn't really had a significant hit. And then she made Chinatown, which kind of threw her back into the top ranks, which leads to her being cast in Network, which of course gets her her Oscar. So this is a very significant film for her by all accounts. And I will say this is not that different from most accounts of a Dunaway film. She did not get along well with anyone. And and there was some type of incident that had something to do with her peeing in a glass or something, because Polanski wouldn't let her go to the bathroom or something. And yes, that is a thing that happened.
Wow. I didn't know that. That's wild.
Yeah, I know. It is it's something. But she I mean, like, what can you say? But anyway, she does have a quality about her that is very, very 1940s, very much 30s, 40s, fits very well with the time period. And a lot of times when you see Faye Dunaway in films, particularly because of her, she has that transatlantic cadence accent to her voice. Mm-hmm. She almost seems out of time. She almost seems like she's supposed to be in a different period, because she's simultaneously very much of the 70s. With the films, the extremely influential, edgy films that she's involved with, but she feels like she's of a different era, you know.
Yeah.
Her looks feel older too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's true. And so you mentioned the fashion. That's one thing I wanted to bring up too before we get into the spoiler stuff. So I watched this movie on HBO, and right now they have Alicia Malone has a new show coming out on TCM and HBO called Follow the Thread, fashion designers. And so she has a little intro where she talks about the fashion and also does kind of the TCM intro thing. And she talks about the fashion designer for this film, who I'm going to look up the name of really quick, unless you know it offhand, is Anthea Silbert. And I think she was nominated for the Oscar, maybe won that year for costume. But talk about how significant the fashion was in this movie, and for both Faye Dunaway and for Jack Nicholson, and all these three-piece suits and everything.
Well, and, I mean, there was a 40s resurgence in the 70s. Yeah. That's something that should be.
Yeah, she mentioned that. Yeah,
The kind of suit look, you know, that came back.
Yeah, so that's an interesting tie-in, and then. My favorite little anecdote from that was that Jack Nicholson once said of Anthea Silbert, the costume designer, said you know, when you're, she calls her the aunt because her name's Anthea. When you're working with the aunt, you don't have to act as hard or something like that. And she said that was the greatest compliment she'd ever received as a costume designer. Thought that was a cool thing.
She did not, she was not, she never won. She was nominated a couple of times, including for this, but she was not, she did not win. How sad. Well, I don't know what won in 74.
Great costumes in this though, anyway.
But I mean, you know, she was also nominated for Julia, which is another movie that takes place in the 30s. So,
period fashion thing.
Oh, Great Gatsby won this year. Interesting. Lots of period films in the category, too, because we got Daisy Miller, The Godfather Part II, and Murder on the Orient Express.
Wow.
As I said, 74, I just, one of my other favorite movies that came out this year is also part of the neo-noir movement, The Conversation, which is the movie that Coppola wanted to make and made Godfather Part II so he could make The Conversation. And then both movies came out in the same year and both were nominated for Best Picture. Wow. And both very much have noir tendencies. Chinatown, we got Dunaway, we got Nicholson, we got Houston, got Polanski.
Yeah. Anything else significant we need to talk about before we get into the movie?
I mean, I think we got to start getting into...
I think we're ready. Yeah.
Yeah.
So at this point, if you have not watched Chinatown, we are going to spoil stuff. So highly recommend go watch it. It's on HBO. And then come back. Yeah. All right. Spoiler time. So yeah, this movie, my big takeaway is like, I can't believe I'd forgotten the twist and just how dark the ending is. Like, I was thinking about with Nightmare Alley, which we watched, you know, very dark film. And then there's this remake where you kind of see the violence and you see the darkness a little more, where in the original, you know, some of it happens off camera and some of that. And it's like, and I think we both talked about how we kind of like that about it. In this feels very much, you know, homage to all of that, but so much darker than you could have been maybe in the, at least explicitly in the 30s and 40s. But I think all the better for it. Cause I think, yeah, I love the ending of this as horrible as it is and as dark as it is, but yeah, I was taken aback. I think I've said that in every single one of these episodes, but I was taken aback by how dark this was.
The twist is, spoiler.
Yeah.
Spoiler. the twist, in case anyone is wondering, is that Faye Dunaway has someone we think is a sister, but it is her daughter with her father, who is John Huston. And there is a famous moment where she confesses this and she's crying hysterically and she says, "My sister, my daughter." The movie ends with her trying to get away, and not making it. And then we get one of the great closing lines of all time, as Jack Nicholson looks back on a tragic, bloody scene, which is surprisingly bloody, by the way, whenever they have a quick shot of her face, they're like, "Oh, I wasn't expecting to see all that." which sharpshooter, by the way.
Yeah, it's like half of her face. But yeah, and then the worst part of it for me too is her daughter's reaction. Like, it's so well acted and so horrifying and harrowing. And then of course that Noah Cross, the villain here, comes in and he's gonna get off scot-free. And like, that's, so it's horrifying.
Forget it, Jake.
Then tell us the line there. Sorry, I cut you off.
Yeah, forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown. And that's the end. And then we walk away. And that's, you know, I don't know if Chinatown's still that dark here or not. I don't think it is. But here in LA, I don't know if it ever was. I feel like this is all an invention of the film. But it's so it says so much. It's such an interesting message, as so many noirs are, about corruption and the way that the powerful really have this ability to wield the balance of justice in their favor. And this is such a great commentary on that.
I was just reading an article on the Criterion's website that I'll link in the show notes, but it was talking about neo-noirs, and on this one it said something about the horrifying ellipsis, like the dot 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 of this movie is like he gets away, like what's coming after the events of this film are what's so horrifying. It compares it to The Exorcist in that way. I thought was interesting. It's like, okay, this like evil spirit is out into the world now, and like this is a real thing we're scared of, and like this corrupt, horrible patriarchal system, this is real life. Like and then pointed out the line too that's so significant. There's when Jack Nicholson says, "Don't run away," to Faye Dunaway, like, "Let the police handle this," and she says, "He owns the police. Like, there is no escape here," and that's part of what's so horrifying about it.
It's an interesting, and I think this is one of the things that separates film noir from neo noir is that we're post production code, and so these darker endings don't need to be watered down. You can let the bad guy win, basically, and the bad guy didn't win in the 40s, you know? And that's what makes this so haunting, though, you know, and what gives that last line so much punch is the fact that the beat goes on, the corruption continues. It won't stop.
Yeah. More realistic ending in a way too, I think. And yeah, really a tough one. I was like, holy shit.
What an
really, yeah. very good movie. I guess changing gears, like, where do we go from here? So I was watching and I was kind of keying into what are the noir things about this? Like, you've mentioned most of it already. Like, it's a really dark and gritty story. We've got a detective, these kind of hard-nosed guy, literally his nose is part of the story. And then, this femme fatale. I thought the music was really, you know, kind of felt of that time as well. There's even a few, I think it's like a harp in a few moments that reminded me a little bit of that zither of The Third Man.
And
felt like maybe a little bit of a connection there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I hadn't thought about that. Yes.
I don't know. Maybe not intentional. Actually,
it's Jerry Goldsmith.
Oh, okay. The first thing you hear in the score is like a little harp, like vroom, and I was like, is this The Third Man? But go ahead. Yeah.
Jerry Goldsmith worked all the way up until his death in 2004. He was nominated for 18 Oscars. He won for The Omen in 76, which has a very haunting, vocally driven score, if y'all haven't seen that movie. But he also did the Brendan Fraser version of The Mummy, lest we forget. L.A. Confidential's, Gremlins, Alien, Poltergeist, Patton, Planet of the Apes, and he did the 97 fanfare for Universal Pictures, and the 76 fanfare for Paramount, who released this film. So he had a very prolific career, and of course this score is among his best known.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear that there's so many horror things in there in his work, because there's definitely some horror feeling things in this. There's like all the way on the low end of the piano, like dun 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 kind of moments a few times. I was like, that's kind of cool. But I didn't know that about him.
There's everything in the atmosphere of this film, you know, the cinematography too, let's not forget to mention. Because, you know, we're dealing with color noir.
Right.
And so there's this kind of this look that is very 70s of the desaturated kind of brownish.
Like some of it's out in the desert and that kind of thing, where there's just like dry, the drought part of it. You see all this this dry ground.
A lot of movies in the 70s have this kind of dry. I mean, you know, orange was a popular color in the 70s, and there's that tint to it. You think of the way The Godfather looks. You know? Mm-hmm. It's kind of the same dark look about it. Which, I mean, again, speaking of neo-noir, this is the year that Godfather Part II wins Best Picture, which has some relation, is not necessarily a neo-noir, but is has some lineage, I would say. And particularly in the look of how it's shot. And so you have these cinematographers in the 70s, which, let's give credit where credit is due, the guy who shot this movie is John A. Alonso, who was nominated for this film and a short film, and that's all he ever got nominated for. Poor guy. You know, but he did Scarface, he did Steel Magnolias, he did a few, Lady Sings the Blues, he did a few, Close Encounters of the Third Kind he helped with. He was not the only one on that. Norma Rae, he did some significant films, but I would say, like, as far as look goes, this is far and away the most identifiable of what he did. And there, it's just like, LA looks so not desolate, it looks so I don't know if empty is the right word either. It looks so lonely.
Yeah, I would say lonely in this movie. A good word.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The shot I was going to mention is after he, where have they been? I'm trying to remember. It's like they, I can't remember where they've gone, that they've just escaped somewhere and they're in the convertible and she's driving and they're driving through the valley, and it's just, oh, they've been at the nursing home. That's right. Where they've just discovered this plot that all these people who are dead or almost dead, their identity is being used to purchase this land fraudulently. So they're driving back from there, but just that gorgeous shot, they're having a conversation. It's kind of this like faded purple kind of sunset. And just the coloring and the lighting of it is really gorgeous. And that's the image that is probably going to stick in my mind from this one.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of what sticks in my mind. I think about like whenever they, where's the location they go to when he's doing his detecting work and he goes up the fence. I can't think of.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. It's like a part of the water reservoir. He's like,
yeah, part of the water reservoir. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like he jumps the fence and then, yeah, it's just this like darkness and then the water rushes in. Is that the scene you're talking about? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just like, as somebody who lives in Los Angeles, I think I identify in one way or another with every single movie that takes place here, because there are so many facets to the city. There are days where I feel like it's the, you know, another day of sun in La La Land. And there's days where I feel like it's Chinatown, where there is this kind of the worst underbelly of LA, as there can be in this mass of people, this kind of pervasive loneliness, like you are a traveler on your own, making it through a city where there's a million other people trying to make it too. And everybody is out for themselves, because the way that you survive is by beating someone else. You know, it's that audition culture drives a city built on an entertainment industry. And Chinatown, even though it's not about the entertainment industry, it really captures that dog eat dog world of that is one aspect of LA.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. I think the only other thing I was going to say about the kind of the noir feeling elements to this is the dialogue, and how a lot of it is a little bit fast paced and kind of witty in the way that we see like Humphrey Bogart coming up with these comebacks and being so biting. And that's where the smart aleck kind of vibe of Jack Nicholson works so perfectly. That line I was mentioning is where he's like a detective that or private investigator that is known for capturing adultery, which we should also mention, as far as the dark and grittiness goes, like the opening shot of this is he's showing, it's close up of these photographs of two people having sex, like in a field.
Yes.
And then we zoom out and realize he's showing this to the cuckolded husband, right? And who's devastated. But it's like a really kind of edgy opening, I felt, opening with that kind of grittiness.
Let's not forget that we also get a really great little performance. Not a very large performance, but like a memorable performance from Diane Ladd, who is...
Oh, she plays Edith Sessions. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. She's at the beginning of the film. And in case you guys didn't know, Diane Ladd is the mother of Laura Dern.
I did not know. Wow.
Yeah, Laura Dern. She was at the time she was married to Bruce Dern, and they had Laura.
Yeah, she's great in her small part here.
Yeah, I mean, fantastic, totally.
Yeah, that's another. Yeah, takes place in the office where he is. She shows up to hire him. And anyway, if you're listening now, you've seen the movie, so you know who she is. But the line I was going to mention, which is later, where he's the man has died, Faye Dunaway's husband, who is Hollis Mulray, and he's talking to Mulray's boss or like replacement, and he says, the boss says, well, you can tell the kind of person who chases women. It's like they're either he's the kind of person who chases women or he isn't. And Jack Nicholson says, and you're saying he isn't? Like this guy you knew so well isn't? He said, he never even jokes about it, or he never even kids about it. And then Jack Nicholson says, with this like smart ass smile, well, maybe he takes it very seriously. I thought that was so funny. That just really cracked me up. And it was his delivery of it. And it was like the perfect like Jack Nicholson moment of like, it's not a joking matter to
Jack. Yeah. So many levels so to his one. Career, too. I mean,
yeah,
we went from, I mean, you get Chinatown and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and then you get Terms of Endearment, and you get As Good as It Gets and The Departed. You know, he's someone who really managed to evolve.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it's because he's so unique, you know, and he's not. I don't know. He doesn't look like anyone else. And, you know, and of course, like The Shining. And
yeah, he has such a wild energy. Yeah. The Shining is a thing that I maybe first saw him in, actually, I'm trying to think, but yeah, just that kind chaotic. Of aggressive and chaotic. Yeah. And like the scene that you mentioned where she confesses, he's like slapping her across the face, or which we should mention, like the violence against women in this is pervasive, not like not on
really
like he's the hero here and he's doing that. As soon as that started happening, I was like, oh yeah, I remember this scene, I remember what's happening. Like it all clicked back when he started slapping her in the face.
It is it's interesting to think about that violence against women with
yeah, one of the things
happens with the director a couple years after this.
Yeah right, so like him being accused of raping teenagers, and here in the movie our villain has done that, and that's like the plot twist is really an interesting thing to this an interesting irony
awful
yeah thing.
It's it's one of the It really feels like Chinatown's an interesting one to end this series on, because it really does feel like the unrestrained version of some of what we've seen in the 40s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Noir.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The, on the violence of women thing too, and some it's so interesting because it's like, okay, we can see some of this maybe is commentary, like this is a bad thing and like he's showing that, but then also some of it's kind of baked into the degree of like this is just misogyny that was in the screenwriting because it felt realistic. But the first scene, he, you know, he's got this husband who's just found out he's been cheated on, and it's been proved with these photos, and he says something about like, you just got a bad girl or something, like something very kind of dismissive and misogynistic sounding. And then in the next scene, when Edith Sessions is there, who's, you know, pretending to be someone else and all of that, but his advice to her is, if you love your husband, let sleeping dogs lie. Just don't worry about it. Let this go away. Forget about it. It's which is such an interesting contrast of like how he responds to a woman cheating and how he's responding to a man cheating, which, so anyway,
says everything you need to know right there.
Yeah. There you go.
Welcome to the 70s. Yeah. The other thing about the 70s is that there's some filmmakers who make some really, really amazing, great work in the 70s. And I don't want to take away from any of that. But the new wave movement that came in that included neo-noir, that included the groundbreaking films by Spielberg and Scorsese and Coppola, it was a very male-dominated situation. And there were not very many female filmmakers in the mix, and those that were there were people like Elaine May, who made a really successful comedy called The Heartbreak Kid in the early 70s, but you know, after she in the 80s made the rather notorious bomb Ishtar, didn't direct again. It's or if she has, it was never anything of that level of stature. Mm-hmm. It's we should point out here, the 70s had some really incredible things going on filmmaking wise, but it was the voices driving it were white guys.
Yeah.
And if women were allowed into the club, they were not given the chances that the men were.
Yeah. Yeah. And how so many of those male filmmakers who didn't have a huge hit, but were given more opportunities, whereas like Elaine May, like that was it, you know, pretty much.
Well, you've had a failure, so we're not gonna, you know, I mean, there's occasionally a male where that would happen. I mean, after Heaven's Gate, Cimino, that's how you say his name, the guy who did The Deer Hunter, he wasn't.
I think that's right. I don't know.
Yeah, he wasn't given much. Cimino?
I'm not sure.
Really messing up his name. I'm very sorry. He didn't get much chances after that, but rarely. Usually a guy is given a chance in Hollywood. I mean, a director, you know, you miss on a couple films, they give you a couple more chances. If you're a female filmmaker and you strike out, you're done. Yeah.
This is barely related to what we're talking about, but it's making me think about it. Have you watched the show Barry?
I haven't. I heard it's fantastic.
It's loneliness in LA is a big part of it. It's like about the LA culture. It's a story. It's Bill Hader acts in it and created it and directs a lot of the episodes. But there's also some commentary about that exact thing where, so he's trying to be an actor, but he's secretly a hitman and he's trying to put that life behind him. And it's kind of got that Breaking Bad thing of like acting like a regular guy, but has this criminal thing that's the secret, but very funny, but also really chilling, and like I'm almost caught up, but it's really good. But yeah, exactly that, where he's dating someone who has been like working and working and working and working to try to break into the industry and is finally barely getting a chance, and then he like happens to be in the right place at the right time, like, hey, you're really tall, you want to come read for this really big role? Like, just a comedic kind of commentary on the gender gap there in the entertainment industry. So I recommend Barry to you and to anyone listening.
I gotta tell you, one of my favorite things, this is an LA insider thing, whenever that show first came on, you know, Henry Winkler is a talent agent in the movie, correct?
Yeah, he's like an acting coach and he's sort of a failed actor. Yeah.
There were suddenly all over LA, there were those, bus stop advertisements where it's on the bench that were advertising his services, the character's services, but it's Henry Winkler's in the show face. Too.
Yeah.
And that was a great way to get me talking. Cause I was just like, that's Henry Winkler. Why?
That's a perfect like viral marketing thing. I love that. That's cool.
Which Henry Winkler, one of the great. It has nothing to do, but Happy Days started around the time Chinatown came out, so
that's true. There you go. Sort of connected. He is so good in Barry as well. Like, I'm consistently really impressed. Like, I love him in like Arrested Development and, you know, and so these things as in his older age, but I think he gets to be really funny in this and also some really heart-wrenching dramatic things too. It's a really a masterclass in like tone between comedy and
legitimately
really.
Guys, the most genius piece of casting ever is when the Bluth family has to get rid of Henry Winkler as their His name is Barry, isn't he? On the show.
Barry Zuckerkorn.
He's very good. But they they have to get rid of him, and they replace him with Scott Baio, or Chachi, from Happy Days.
So good.
His name is Bob Blah Blah. But there's also like so many, like Ron Howard's doing the narration, and he'll occasionally make a sly reference to Happy Days, or that moment where Henry Winkler's in the mirror and he goes,
"Yeah, hey. Yeah, he does his exact Fonzie thing." It's so good.
That show is there's probably a Chinatown reference in it somewhere. That show is so layered and so good. The first three seasons in particular.
You know what? I just remembered I was going to mention this to Allison, but in Barry, again, I know Bill Hader is someone who's like a big student of film. He's on TCM and stuff all the time, so he's like a big classic film guy. There's a character in Barry named Detective Loach, and there's a character in Chinatown named Detective Loach, which
I think must not be on accident,
right? I think that must be on purpose. So there you go. Yes. Well, what more do we need to say about Chinatown? We've gotten off track, but I think it's good stuff. But yeah,
I mean, it's a great movie. It's something that everybody should see. We've given you all of the heavy warnings in terms of Polanski.
Yeah.
Take that as you will, but this is undoubtedly one of the most influential and important films in a very creatively fruitful period from the 1970s, in particular 74, which has a treasure trove of great movies.
Yeah, I was going to mention it's on the, you know, I think it's number 12 in the list of the 100 greatest films and American films, and like the British Film Institute has it on their Sight and Sound list. So it's one of those movies that's like one of the greats on all the lists. So yeah, for that reason alone, it's significant. And yes, the Roman Polanski-ness of it all is, you know, something to a grain 21st, of salt to bring 11th, in with you.
21st. Sorry. Oh, okay. But it is the number two ranked mystery film, has the ninth best score, according to the AFI. Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown's a 74 ranked movie quote.
Oh, quote, yeah.
Noah Cross is the 16th ranked villain. And in the thrills list, it's number 16, too. So
it's a big deal of a movie. And I'm so glad to have revisited it, you know, after, you know, 10 years later and being much more mature as far as my cinematic knowledge. Definitely a lot to appreciate. And it's so good to watch all these noirs in a row and then appreciate it in that light as well. Because I think, yeah, when I saw it 10 years ago, I still can't believe I forgot the twist. I think if I had like seen her face or like seen a clip of that scene, I would be like, oh yeah, I remember everything about this movie. But I'm actually kind of glad that I got to have the fresh experience again with it. But yeah, really a rich film and a rich experience after having a little more noir knowledge myself. The reason I do these film series is like, okay, I need to know more about film noir. So I'm going to get Rance to come explain it to me. But, made this movie better too.
Good. I mean, like, I will find something else that I can explain well. Yeah. I know that you're just itching to do that. I'm trying to think of something really, that Doris Day series
that'd be great.
You want to do the series of Elvis movies from the 60s, you know, whatever. Well, that'd
be good. We could cap it off with this new Elvis movie, which I haven't watched just yet.
I haven't watched it yet. And yeah. I'm actually writing an article tonight for TCM because Elvis is one of their stars of the day and Summer Under the Stars for August. And so if you see that article on TCM's website,
yeah,
it should be up on August 1st. That is, will be written by me. So I have to write about Elvis's film career this evening. So,
which I think, as I recall, that I don't know if you want me to reference your film career here with a movie musical, that there were some Elvis things in there, as I remember many years ago.
I definitely sent up some, Clam Bake being
yes like, I remember Clam Bake, that's right, yes, that's right.
Elvis's film career, and I think they I as I understand it, they kind of speed through it in the movie that just came out, which I've heard really good things about, and my dad, who is a huge Elvis fan, approved of it, so he's going to be the most critical person out there, so
that's high praise. That's cool.
But it's Baz Luhrmann, which, you know, he has a very distinctive style. Yeah. So, which is basically like, take a deep breath because you're going to get
gonna be exhausted
a cut every 0.5 seconds. And
yes.
I mean, it's a little bit of a fever dream when you're with Baz, but I look forward to, I have a feeling it's not a neo-noir. That's just a yeah, guess.
Probably not. Based on the other Baz Luhrmann things I've seen, probably not. That is Chinatown. Thank you so much, Rance, for this wonderful series of films, and thank you for sticking with me through the long gap of having to do some other things and finish it up.
No problem at all.
But yeah, really enlightening and such a joy to have you with us. And yeah, thanks so much.
Joy to be here.
Oh, well, good. I feel so grateful to have Rance as a regular contributor to this podcast. This film noir series has been great, and I certainly feel like I have a much better grasp of noir than I did before we started. Well, now that we're done with noir, I'm happy to announce the next film series we're going to be doing, another film movement I've long felt that I need to understand better, is the French New Wave. These are films from the late 50s and 60s from French filmmakers that changed cinema forever by breaking all the rules. I'm excited to learn more about the history and watch through four films with the help of longtime friend of the show, Omaya Jones. Omaya is incredibly smart, and he loves to research film things and then just spill his knowledge on the podcast, so I'm really excited to get into these. We will do four episodes, and here are the subjects. First, we'll do an intro to the French New Wave and look at the film Vivre sa vie from Jean-Luc Godard. By the way, I don't really speak French, so this series is going to be a lot of me mispronouncing French words. I apologize in advance. The second episode we're going to do is Jules and Jim by François Truffaut, and we're going to look at a short film, La Jetée, from director Chris Marker. Omaya says it's one of the best short films ever made, so we're going to throw that in on episode two. Episode three, a little more of a history lesson with What is the Left Bank? So the Left Bank is sort of a sub-movement within French New Wave, at least that's as I understand it at this point. Excited to learn more. And we'll look at a film that fits into that category, which is One Sings, The Other Doesn't, from Agnès Varda. And then finally, we'll wrap up with a look at Umbrellas of Cherbourg from Jacques Demy, and we'll kind of do a series conclusion. I can't wait to get into all this with Omaya. I'm really looking to bolster my knowledge of this era, and hopefully you can too by watching and listening along. But next week, before we get into the French New Wave, I'm planning to review a new film, and it's one I've been very excited to see. It's Jordan Peele's Nope. So stay tuned for that. And with that, thank you for listening to Arthouse Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes now. You can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, become a patron at patreon.com/arthousegarage or find a link in the show notes. And you can also buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. If you want to support us without spending any money, you can leave a rating or review in your podcast app. You can also stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening, and until next time, keep it snob free.